thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
It's Digital Campus number 83, recorded on the 16th of March, 2012. Spring broke. And it's time for the spring break edition of the Digital Campus podcast here at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media on the campus of George Mason University, the very quiet campus of George Mason University, since all the students are away in locales to the south of here and the mulch machines are going outside our offices, or at least my office and Mills's office. Mills, are you on the line? Mills Kelly.
I am on the line.
Your mulch machines have gone quiet a little bit. I guess they're using this time momentarily to plant things and mulch things this week.
Well, we have to make the university look good for all the potential new freshmen who will be coming to visit us over the next few weeks.
That's true.
So that they will think it's actually a really beautiful campus.
That's right. It is. It's a leafy suburban campus.
It has the advantage of being true. It is a beautiful campus.
It is. It is. And we've got Tom Scheinfeld, I think, from New York City. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan. Yep. I'm in New York for a wedding. So a little bit of a change of pace. Rainy New York today.
Oh, that's too bad. That is too bad because it's actually the sun's coming out here. It's rather nice, very springish. And Amanda French. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Dan.
Broadcasting, I think, from home today.
From Capitol Hill. It's a hop, skip, and a jump away from the Capitol.
Gosh, look at this. We've got New York, Washington, Capitol Hill.
And Fairfax.
And Mulchville, USA, out in Fairfax, Virginia. Okay, well, it is a spring break edition. Hey, did anyone see this story in the cover, front page story in the New York Times this morning about spring break being ruined by smartphones and Facebook?
No.
I'll link to it from the show notes, but basically the gist was that you know, the iPhone and Facebook, or phones with cameras and Facebook, have just ruined spring break, which used to be just totally tawdry. But now, since everyone is like snapping photographs of these wild beach parties and putting them up on Facebook, no one's doing anything anymore. And they spoke to some glum students and bartenders in Key West who said, yeah, you know, nothing fun happens anymore because everyone's got their phones out snapping photos. So
sounds like there's a thesis in that, you know, the moral influence of perpetual broadcast.
I think there's a panopticon going on here. This is the second thing that has been ruined, a story like this. They had a story a few months ago about it ruining high school reunions, because now everybody actually knows what everyone looks like 25 years later,
or right, yes,
who they're also married to. There's no surprise anymore.
It's ruining dictatorship, too.
Yeah.
Just ruin everything.
All the good things in life.
Yeah, I joked on Twitter this morning that, you know, that scene in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome where Mad Max shows up at Bartertown and there's this like window when he comes to the gate and they're like, give us all of your weapons. And he has to like dump out his guns and his knives and things like that. And I just have this feeling that in the future there'll be spring break destinations like Fort Lauderdale where like you get off the plane and there's like a burly guy and he says like, give me your iPhone now. Cannot proceed into our dome with these devices that record.
You haven't tried to go to a courthouse recently.
Same thing there, right? Yeah. Is it true that they're this Western Kentucky story that they're trying to get rid of social media on the campus of Western Kentucky? I didn't track this story, but Amanda,
yeah.
did you see this?
Yeah,
they're cracking down on the use of it at WKU.
Yeah,
cracking down on faculty use, or
no? It's actually, you know, this is a little bit different. We've seen some stories about people banning social media for the purposes of concentration and education, that sort of thing. This is actually a different thing, where Western Kentucky University is cracking down on negative comments about Western Kentucky University in social media. So they have a policy that's meant to control what students say about WKU in social media. So basically, if they find out that you're making terrible comments about them, they will come after you. I don't know exactly what they're going to do. But there was a specific incident where there was a parody account, as you know, those things often proliferate on Twitter, but there was a parody account, right, making, you know, snotty comments about WKU, and they convinced Twitter to shut that down. So that was the specific incident that led to this. But apparently there are also, you know, establishing official policies that you're not allowed to make fun of WKU.
Wow.
That is,
I mean,
bizarre.
That seems like, gosh, yeah, that seems like a fairly like clear-cut First Amendment issue. I mean, this is a public university, right? I mean, like, you can't, that a tuition-paying student at a public university can't criticize the organ of government. That seems bizarre.
Well, and it's gonna work really well too, I think.
I should say too, they don't have this policy yet. They are discussing establishing this policy, yeah. And they're it's kind of interesting because, again, according to this one article that we have, which is maybe a slightly dicey source, but according to this one article, which we'll link to, they're kind of framing it in the rhetoric of online harassment, like bullying. You know, so
bullying,
like,
the university.
Don't bully the
bullying
university,
the university.
You know, yeah.
The poor provost.
I know.
Wow. Yeah, well, I have to say, having served on the social media policy committee of George Mason University, I have been through this. I think, you know, even on that committee, they worry about the, like, insignias and colors and flags and these, like, you know, because some students actually on their, for instance, on their Twitter avatar have, like, the Mason logo stamped on it. And right. So they worry that it's somehow, I don't know,
Misusing the brand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now that we all have a brand promise magnet here at George Mason, that, you know, we have to pay attention to these things.
That's right.
Did you get your brand promise magnet?
I did get my brand promise magnet, and more.
Yes. Including instructions about how you're supposed to now change all your employees' evaluations to reflect the brand promise of George Mason University.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I'm actually not technically employed by George Mason University, but I was considering, you know, objecting strongly to that language because it just seems so anti-educational. But, you know, I'm not actually technically, I'm affiliated with George Mason, but I'm not actually an employee. I don't know.
So you're safe from the brand promise police.
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, it is true that, speaking of brands and fake Twitter accounts, that fake Elsevier now has more followers than the real Elsevier, which is indeed a triumph. And we have some follow-up, I suppose, on this podcast. And one of them is that it was right after we recorded the last podcast, the Research Works Act took a nosedive. And we probably don't need to post-mortem it at this point a few weeks later. But I do think that mockery and shame, such as in fake Twitter accounts, can have an effect on public opinion. So kudos to whoever fake Elsevier is. And it is good to be on fake Elsevier's enemies list as well. So I think all of us
are. You're so lucky.
You're not on it?
So lucky. No,
you can request it. No, I don't know. You are an enemy. You are an enemy.
I'll put you on my list. Oops.
All right. Okay.
Okay, well, we are recording this in the morning of the dawning of the new era that is the iPad 3. We can't even call it the iPad 3.
No, the new, it's just the iPad.
The new iPad, just the iPad. iPad has been brought to us, and now we are in it. We are living in its new, its glow of its 3 million pixels. And I suppose we should mention this. Anyone going to get one of these glorious new iPads? Well, I'll take that silence as as an answer.
Are you Dan? I know you.
No, I mean, I'm a heavy iPad user, and I know. You know what? I do have to say, I do a lot of reading on the iPad, and just for the Instapaper, I'm a little bit tempted, but I'm gonna, you know,
by the screen.
I'm gonna lash myself to, you know, I don't know. I can't do it. I can't go there. I'm not gonna go to the Tyson's Corner Apple Store. Let this go on this recording, this permanent recording, here on the Digital Campus Podcast with three witnesses and a notary public.
Longtime listeners to this podcast will remember a similar conversation about a thing called the iPhone.
I know.
When a certain Dan Cohen told us he was not getting anywhere near the Tyson's Corner Apple Store because he knew that once he went in, he would probably buy one.
I know.
And that lasted, Tom, what, 6 weeks? Something like that.
Yeah.
So we'll check back, listeners.
You're right. See, my palms are sweating right now as we record this. But I do think that reading on it is going to be a lot nicer. Sigh. Okay. But it looks to me, and we will link to this story from the show notes, but tablet ownership, which of course in most cases means iPad ownership, is way up among students, three times the rate. What's going on there, Mills?
You know, I have to say, I'm really seeing it in my classes.
Me too.
Semester. I mean, yeah. I have not as many students with tablets as with laptops, but they're closing in terms of distribution. I mean, just based on the size of their backpacks alone, they really need tablets instead of laptops, just to preserve this curvature of their spine. But I see lots more students now with the tablets. And I would say I think that they are using them in exactly the same ways. So I don't know that it's really been revolutionary other than in terms of size so far. For one thing, you know, I don't have things in my classes that are designed intrinsically to take advantage of what a tablet or even a laptop can do, other than, you know, when I'm talking about things and rather than me calling it up on the screen, I'll just point to a student in the class and say, okay, take a look at that and tell us about it. And so, but they can do that on a tablet or a laptop. It doesn't really matter. But I do see just a lot more tablets this semester.
Yeah, me too. You know, I did notice even in the fall where there were quite a few students with iPads. Maybe this is just me, but have you noticed that it's a little bit less disruptive to the class?
There's something
about that screen of the laptop being vertical and the clickety clack of the keyboard. You know, I just feel like they're not Facebooking as much during the class.
Even if they are, having the most of them let the tablet lie flat on the table.
The
desktop. And so that, you know, you don't have the peer over the shoulder effect as much. And so that's made a difference. And certainly it's quieter. And there is, you know, I think you're right that there's I think that they're less involved with the rest of the world. It's possible that I'm just deluding myself.
Yeah. I mean, it could be the full screen apps. You know, I mean, the fact that, you know, the iPad and tablets run apps full screen, you know, they're not windowed.
Right.
So there's not, you know, so it's not like they're, you know, once upon a time their IM client was, you know, going off or they were reading their email or, you know, they're in their note taking application or whatever they're doing and that's where they are.
Are you using them to take notes, Mills and Dan?
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple students who, you know, have a stylus and they're sitting there writing away. But others are definitely taking notes or, you know, looking up something in the notes that they took on some device, whether the iPad or a home computer or a laptop, you know, and calling those back up and reading from them, you know, a quotation or something like that. So, you know, they're definitely taking notes and looking at things.
Yeah. You know, what's amazing in this survey is that we went from 7% of students owned a tablet to 25%. you know, quarter of the students. Pretty amazing. But I think the even scarier stat, if you're a laptop manufacturer, is that 63% of the college students surveyed believe that tablets will replace their textbooks and, you know, and effectively their laptops. I mean, or that they're liking reading on this and that they prefer the environment of the tablet for their work, you know, as the thing, as you said, that they lug around or not lug around because it's so light.
Yeah, I mean, how can you not prefer reading a textbook on a tablet as opposed to a laptop screen?
Yeah.
The you know, in some respects, I think the bigger announcement that Apple made, you know, I think that the high resolution screen is the Retina display is cool, and I think it will improve the product, and it will continue to distance, I think, the iPad from all of its competitors. I think it's just, you know, it was already way out in front, and now it's like way better. But I actually think that the dropping, you know, they're keeping the iPad 2 around, which is the same form factor. It just basically, it's the same device. It just has a lower resolution screen. They're keeping that around and dropping the price to $399. And I think that, I mean, that's just going to accelerate this trend of students owning laptops. The fact that it's, you know, it's not $600 anymore, it's $400. I think that's going to make a big difference in tablet ownership. I think in the fall, I think I would expect to see a lot of students coming in with that kind of lower level iPad 2.
Yeah, you know, for digital textbooks, actually, the Retina display, like if you're a medical student or someone using really high res graphics that you can zoom in on, I do think that the Retina display is going to be really nice and the detail on it. Or frankly, if you're an art historian and you want to, you know, you've got a 50 meg TIFF of an artwork at 8,000 by 8,000 pixels, it's going to make a difference, actually, to be able to zoom in at that level and still have really high quality pixelation or lack of pixelation.
Yeah. I am actually trying to find out whether this survey, which was conducted by Pearson, by the way, the sort of enormous for-profit educational thing. But I'm trying to figure out whether they included things like Kindles in this or if it is just iPads.
Yeah.
I can't tell from what I can find yet. It almost sounds to me, although I'm still looking around, but it almost sounds to me as though they just sort of ask students, do you own a tablet, and are allowing them to state what they mean by that. But I'm assuming that Mills, you and Dan are seeing in your classes primarily iPads. Like, you're not seeing Kindles. I can't imagine bringing a Kindle to class.
Yeah,
I've seen one, I think, and that's it. Everything else is either an iPad or something else that looks from the front of the room like an iPad.
Yeah, they were all iPads in my class. Although one student, I did see a student with a Motorola Zoom, and I almost like had to stop class and just, you know, go over and look at it because it was.
Yeah,
you
know, I know. Like, I've never seen one.
Yeah, it's like seeing a unicorn or something. You're just like, wow, there it is. You know. So anyway, I mean, but I do think this is, you know, considering the source, et cetera, it does show a switch. I mean, this is the year where we went from, and I think we mentioned this on the podcast last year, they did a survey and 6 in 10 students preferred printed textbooks to digital textbooks. And now this year it's 6 in 10 prefer digital books to printed books among the 1,200 students surveyed. So, you know, I think it's a watershed moment. I think everyone feels like, you know, there's a tablet in their future. And I think we're going to see a lot of these being the new iPad. Gosh, it's really annoying. How can you talk about these things? Bad metadata, Apple. Okay. Well, let's follow up on another story, or follow up on MOOCs. Gosh, I hope they don't come to be known this way, but that's what this article in the New York Times is calling them. Multiple, massive, open online courses. What have we called it on the podcast? I think we had something similar, right? Massive courses, massive online courses.
Maybe MOOCs.
It was just, they call it a MOOC. I mean, they literally have this as a acronym, MOOC, MOOCs. And I think we mentioned...
didn't the New York Times just give up, like, spelling World Wide Web out?
Have they finally given that up? Do they lowercase website?
Even, but they're comfortable
sure they
with MOOC?
The reporters still can't say a tweet. They have to say a status update on Twitter.
Right. But MOOC is okay.
Well, the MLA says tweet is okay. Yeah. So I would follow the MLA's guidelines on MOOC as
let's
well.
Let's not even get into the MLA guidelines on tweeting. That's like we're going to have to have a special
Patrick.
Special episode of Digital, a very special Digital Campus. The tweet, what is it? MLA comments. So I've got one quick update on this, and then we'll get to a more meaty story. But we were talking about the various MOOC companies, MOOCOs, I guess we could call them that. All of which have awful, awful names like Udemy. I guess it's like Academy, but with a U in there. And
it's like Uda City.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we riffed off of that. We had a mocking podcast. I think particularly we mocked. I guess it's supposed to be pronounced Udacity, UDACIT. Again, a play on I guess audacity, but it's like Udacity.
Is that and like Mills, the universe? I guess or
I think it's like
university?
Putting the U. Yeah, university or U. It's supposed to evoke all these things. And Mills, I believe you went off on a riff on Udacity, and
I
we
like
decided
Udacity much better.
Udacity. So. For some reason, and I think I know what that reason is, because someone on this podcast is not on Twitter, I received a response on Twitter about our mocking play.
Somebody liked it?
No, actually, I heard from someone who actually works at the company.
Oh, yeah. How about that?
Yeah.
No, are you saying happy. They didn't like it?
They did not like Udacity. They
oh,
were not
on.
Happy with Udacity.
How could they not like Udacity? It's so much better. Udacity. What is that all about?
Okay. Well, if this unnamed person is listening to this podcast, we had to go there. I mean, that's just how it looked to us. Naming is tough. We know that here at the center. And I guess they had gone through various other names where the domain name was unavailable. I had a little bit of a back and forth with this person. And they had also tried for University 21, I think. Which kind of sounds like Century 21 to me.
I know.
Real estate. So I guess they ruled that out. So they were left with Udacity, and Udacity it'll be.
Well, I certainly sympathize with not with all the good domain names being taken.
Yeah, no, it's really true.
We've run into that over and over.
Yeah.
Well, the MOOC that I am that I signed up for, Human Computer Interaction, is actually run by the other spinoff company. Which is Coursera. So
Coursera. Sorry.
I guess so, yeah.
Is that what's his name? Thrun from Stanford?
Is it who?
Thrun, what is his name? Stefan Thrun, the professor who does like robotics and artificial intelligence from Stanford who left the university.
You know, I don't know at all. The specific course that I signed up for is not being taught by him.
Sebastian Thrun, sorry.
Sebastian.
Yeah.
And is Doris Day their official singer?
Coursera. That'd be funny. No, but my course is on hold indefinitely.
Really? Now it's indefinitely.
Well, it's indefinite that they haven't defined it. They still say that it will come about at some point, but it is not happening at all.
Huh. Interesting.
So it's a MOOC, massive online on hold indefinitely course.
Oh, so Sebastian Thrun is in fact the founder of Udacity. Oh man, we are in trouble. So he's the professor who left Stanford after his course had like 120,000 students in it. You know, just sorry, another tangent here, but important to bring in. I was watching a Nova on Netflix with my kids on the Great Robot Race that DARPA sponsored. Do people remember this from a few years ago.
In the desert?
Exactly. Various teams, Stanford, MIT, Carnegie Mellon, and actually some individuals and some companies. You had to have a self-driving car that made its way 130 miles through the desert in Nevada or somewhere, Arizona, Nevada. I can't remember exactly where it was. And one of the featured professors with his students was Sebastian Thrun of U de City, now of U de City. And I thought it was like a fascinating show. I mean, the technology was really interesting, and a lot of it now looks familiar because I think some of the people who were in that race ended up at Google doing the self-driving cars. In fact, a lot of the software looked really familiar to me in terms of how it figures out where the road is and how to deal with obstacles and things like that. But Sebastian Thrun was there, and I was realizing, like, I don't know. I wonder if he's a little bit melancholy moving away from Stanford, and the ability to, he had this great team of students. I mean, most of the work was done by his graduate students on laptops, just writing really cool robot software and like laser eye software. And, you know, they're jumping up and down, and it's that like live interaction that a teacher has with really talented students. And now, you know, to leave that and, I don't know, teach 100,000 students on, I mean, I'm sure he's going to make a ton of money and things like that. But it was interesting that I was shocked in the middle of it. They had a little like overlay with his name and his affiliation. I was like, wow, that's the same guy from U de City.
Well, it's funny. There've been a number of stories on this recently. For instance, Peter Thiel, who notoriously paid students to drop out of college, is teaching at Stanford now.
Right.
Live and in person at Stanford, you know, again, sort of, you know, yet another brick in the wall in support of in-person education. There was an article in the Chronicle this last week or two that has been one of the most popular with Michael Edson, who's a fantastic teacher. He's an anthropologist at KU, and he did a lot of videos that went really viral and is really well known as being an educator who's in favor of using interactive tools, specifically social media and blogging and video and so on with your students. And he published almost a retraction, although that's not exactly right, basically saying that he was going around talking to a lot of teachers who were incorporating technology.
Michael Wesch?
Oh, yeah, Michael Wesch. Michael Edson. Michael Edson is at the
Smithsonian. I thought you were
talking. Michael Wesch is at KU.
Right. Yeah, Kansas State, I think.
K State.
Yep. Okay,
It's a spring break. I don't have to get my actual facts correct. I'm on spring
break. Podcasts, we never get our facts correct. That's our MO.
But at any rate, he's working on a book about teaching, but basically going around saying, look, a lot of teachers were trying to incorporate technology into their classes in the way that I do and finding that it's not working at all. So that now he's going around saying, look, the most important thing is that you establish a connection with your students. And these technologies are one way to do that, but you know, you can make a connection with your students without using any technology at all. And again, the recent another story that we were going to talk about, the fact that Khan Academy has released an iPad app, thus revolutionizing higher education.
Yeah, you know you've arrived when you release your iPad app.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, my basic point of view about Khan Academy. My basic point of view about Khan Academy is that guy is a great teacher. He is teacher. Michael Wesch is a great teacher. It has sort of little to do with the technology. Michael Wesch is able to use technology really well. Sal Khan is able to use technology really well. He's an amazing like video producer, basically. And it has nothing to do with the tools. So anyway, all of these stories are suggesting to me that these MOOCs and other forms of incorporating technology into teaching. I mean, we're seeing just a lot of, I guess you call it technological determinism, where people think it's the technology and it's not the technology. It's the people behind the technology that are making the difference.
Yeah, I mean, has anyone actually done rigorous studies of the effectiveness of these video education channels?
No would be the answer to that.
Yeah, I was wondering. I mean, you know,
there have been a lot of sort of use studies and satisfaction surveys, but nothing that would be called like science.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, if you can even measure learning anyway, scientifically. I mean,
it is possible. It is possible, but in like rigorous conditions. So, right. And so, you know, you have to pretest people, you have to post-test people, you have to do it under the right conditions. I mean, psychologists know how to do this and they do it. Mm. But there are, but it's very time consuming and the results are often kind of small because you have to focus on specific questions. But it is very doable. We just don't do it.
Mm. Yeah. You know, and now, you know, Ted, what to say about Ted? We don't need to
conference series, right?
Or yeah.
Basically a conference series, yes, where they have short 18-minute talks by, you know, very engaging speakers.
Right. Yes. And we don't need to go down the rabbit hole. That would be hating on Ted. They have now released educational videos, which actually I think are even shorter than the 18 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, they're going to be shorter.
Yeah. So they're in this realm now too, and yet we're still not entirely sure what the effect of videos are. That's an interesting story, Amanda, about Michael Wesch, because you know he was really considered one of the, incorporating new media into the classroom, getting away from the lecture one-to-many ideology of most of the academy.
Kudos to him for revisiting it.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking over you.
No, I'm talking over you. Let's talk over each other. No. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, at least with Michael Wesch, I mean, the thing about Michael Wesch is that he had his students make videos and he would make videos with them. And some of those videos went really viral. These things like Khan Academy and the TED education talks and these MOOCs that I'm supposed to be involved in, many of which are just, as far as I can tell, just releasing videos. Those are all steps backward in a way. It doesn't matter how many people are in the class. It's still sage on the stage. It's just that the sage is behind, or is in front of a video camera, right? So Michael Wesch is already ahead of the curve of some of these MOOCs, as far as I'm concerned. And then even he is kind of retreating a little bit.
My feeling, I think, about these things, maybe not the MOOC so much, but they're probably part of this as well. But certainly the Khan Academy and the TED Ed stuff is, I think they may be useful tools for, communicating information, communicating knowledge, and they may be very good at that. But that doesn't constitute, to me, education, right? They're not part of a broader discussion. They're not incorporated into a curriculum. It still requires a teacher to do that. Now they may be pieces that a teacher can use, but it's still sort of up to the teacher to look at these things, roll them into a larger kind of lesson, a larger framework that can really make an educated person. So they might be, just as we use, it just says when I was a school kid, there were film strips and the teacher used them occasionally. The film strips aren't education. Film strips are just one of many tools that an educator can use to impart education.
Well, and one of the things that Michael Wesch said or was quoted as saying in that Chronicle article, notice that I'm using his name a lot just so that I impress upon people who I'm actually talking about. But he said that one of the things a great teacher can do is, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically just get students excited about the topic, and that conveying that enthusiasm and that sense of wonder is something that I think TEDx videos do well, that I think Khan videos do well, Khan Academy videos. I actually picture the reason behind why I am not currently studying HCI in my 65,000 person MOOC. I picture the reason behind that as the instructors scurrying around trying to develop videos that aren't boring and then like iterating and saying, this video is terrible, we need to try again and bring in more hoopla, and that's, I don't know if that is the reason, but that's what I imagine it to be. just trying to create something that, that gives you the sense of curiosity and wonder and interest that a good TED video will do, or that a good Khan Academy video will do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, related story, who owns these videos now? There was a story in Inside Higher Ed, we'll link to it from the show notes, but a husband and wife professorial duo at Arizona State who designed an online course and are now suing the university on, I think, copyright grounds after they left Arizona State. And basically claim that they owned the course. Mills, you've been following this. What's happening there?
Yeah, well, this is a case of a couple of people who taught in the School of Education. They created an online, as a husband and wife, and one in linguistics, one in education, and created an online course that was for ESL instructors. It was a graduate course. And so they and then they left subsequently in the result of apparently an employment dispute left related to this issue, left and are now at the University of Maryland in the School of Education there. And they are suing their former employer for copyright infringement. And the issue is who owns the course materials that they developed for this online course, because the university is continuing to use those materials with other instructors. So it's not a question of whether the materials are being used. It's not a question of who developed them or whether they're being used by someone else. That's all pretty clear. That what's less clear is who owns the course. Now, we've had a lot of conversations on the podcast about teaching materials being developed by faculty members as work made for hire, and lots of states define it in that way. These particular instructors, faculty, they were both tenured faculty members there, they copyrighted all of those course materials. And so that's the basis of their suit, is that they copyrighted these materials, which are now being used without their permission.
I see. Yeah.
And so it seems to me from everything, and I did a little research on how universities handle this, it seems to me that the issue is going to be whether, in fact, they could copyright it. Like, was it right. copyrighted somehow in error? I think that's what the case is ultimately going to turn on, because the crucial legalese on this, from everything I've been able to read, is whether the materials were, and the crucial phrase is, part of the scope of employment. Were these created as part of the scope of their employment at the university? In other words, it was a general expectation that they would do something like this. So part of the scope of your employment is that you will teach classes if you are a teaching faculty member. And when it comes to research, there, like, I went and looked at what George Mason has to say about this, and we have all sorts of policies online that you can find about intellectual property rights related to patents and research and all of that. I couldn't find anything about teaching. I'm sure it's there somewhere, but I spent 20 minutes looking around and I couldn't find it. So we may be a little unclear. So I tried the state of Virginia, or the Commonwealth of Virginia's Council on Higher Education, and I couldn't find anything there either, except that it says materials created as part of the scope of employment can be, not necessarily, can be claimed by the university, especially if, and this is the other crucial legal phrase, a substantial use of university resources was involved. A substantial use of university resources. Right. And the Commonwealth of Virginia defines that as $10,000 or more. Now, different states,
there was an actual definition. Yeah.
There's an actual definition there. And different states define this in different ways. One, the story in Inside Higher Ed has, they have a link to a paper from 2005, which anybody who's interested in this issue, I strongly recommend. Because, for instance, on page 14, it says they're talking about Marquette University, and Marquette University policy says authors of teaching and classroom materials, such as class notes, syllabi, curriculum guides, or laboratory notebooks, shall grant the university a non-exclusive, royalty-free, perpetual license to use, display, copy, distribute, and prepare derivative works for internal university use. So if these instructors who filed this suit in Arizona worked at Marquette, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on, because as part of their employment, they were granting this license. So they signed off on it. Everybody at Marquette signs off on this, I'm sure, as part of their employment contract.
That's interesting, actually, because as we've talked about before, there's the issue of whether the university owns the copyright in these things, and it's actually work for hire. But Marquette is actually, in a way, kind of smart, because that's not a copyright claim. That's just a license. You know,
that's
you
right.
still own the copyright. We just get to use it.
That's right. We can use it forever for our own purposes. The University of Illinois, the same paper says, the University of Illinois says something similar, but defines if the university is going to develop revenue from it, they actually have a royalty arrangement. So whether that means in addition to royalties generated through the sale of this course to some other, you know, they sell the course to the University of Phoenix for $100,000, would the faculty member who developed the course share in the royalties? Probably, for sure, under what the University of Illinois said, at least in 2005. Does that mean just teaching that same course over and over again, should the faculty member get a percentage of the tuition? I'm sure not. So because we don't get – last time I checked, I wasn't getting any royalty payments from the courses that I'm teaching. So so it's a – this, I think, is going to be a really interesting test case because, you know, not being an attorney but somebody who pays attention on these issues, if the instructors involved are successful in their suit, it will demonstrate that faculty members can, under certain circumstances, copyright course materials that they create and then hold that copyright closely and for purposes of revenue. I mean, they're suing the university for $3 million. So, or if they fail, then, you know, the universities are in a much stronger position because they can cite this as precedent that faculty members cannot claim that kind of copyright over teaching materials. So I think it's going to be a really interesting case.
Huh. Yeah, well, this explains more how you end up with UDacity. I mean, right?
Right.
It just clarifies things if you just leave.
Yeah.
Maybe we shouldn't have mocked UDacity. Maybe we'll all have WeDacity soon.
Yeah. Or MyDacity. MyDacity. That's what I want.
Wait, I am so registering that domain right now.
Too late.
I think we have a title podcast.
MyDacity.
Oh gosh. Well, we're running down on our spring break time, but we have to, I think, end with a quick discussion of Encyclopedia Britannica ending its print run after three centuries. Anyone have any views, Tom?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say I'm sad. I have spent many hours with Encyclopedia Britannica, both, you know, when I was going to, you know, as a school kid, but also I use Encyclopedia Britannica actually a lot as a primary source, the 1913 edition, and then I guess the one that came in
the 11th, like, the 11th edition,
the 11th, yeah. And I use it as a lot as a primary source doing work in the early 20th century. So it's sad not to have that around anymore. At the same time, I mean, it's totally predictable. It was just a matter of time. So,
For people who don't know, the 11th edition, the editors got really prominent people in various fields and good writers as well to do the articles. So they have a little bit more flavor than your average edition of the. Yeah. The EB, but also they're tremendous, right? If you're interested in the history of science, like Tom and me.
It's actually interesting. I actually wrote a good bit about an entry in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica too. It was the entry on the Villanelle. I won't even go into what it was, but it sort of raises the issue. I mean, one of the things that's so great about reference works online, you know, most reference works are like databases now. Let's not even talk about Wikipedia, but talk about like a subscription database that a library gets. Well, they're kind of updated all the time, right? They don't really go through editions, a lot of them. Maybe some of them do. Maybe the OED will and things like that. But it is funny, like when you get inaccurate information overwritten by accurate information, that's great if your only concern is accuracy. It's not so great for sort of the historical record, because what I was writing about with that 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica was exactly, you know, the inaccurate stuff in it as a historical source, you know, and that was just kind of fascinating to see what people believed at that time was correct. So anyway, yeah, it's a shame when you lose the print edition of the history of knowledge in a way. However, of course, on Wikipedia, you can see that history because it's all baked into the baked into the history.
Yeah, you know, friend of the show Tim Carmody had a interesting take on this that was spurred by some discussion from another friend of the show, Yoni Applebaum, a graduate student in history at Brandeis. Tim Carmody, of course, is a writer for Wired and the Great Epicenter blog. And, you know, they were noting that basically, at least for some generations now, post-war generations, the Encyclopedia Britannica really had less of a content significance than just a sort of significance as an entry to the kind of middle-class intelligentsia that you had a shelf of these things at home. They were rather expensive and but rarely cracked open, and it was sort of different than the model in the 19th century and earlier. So Tim, of course, then laid out that really it was replaced by, you know, having a computer in the household, that was a sign that you had reached a certain station and that you were going to educate your kids in a certain way and that you were going to provide them with the best tools of the modern age. And so the kind of stature of the Encyclopedia Britannica eroded first before it was even attacked by the free model of Wikipedia.
I'm gonna be a little bit snotty and mention that not only is Tim Carmody a writer for Wired, and that article was fantastic, he also has a doctorate in comparative literature. So I think that's one of the reasons why that article was so great. He kind of takes a scholarly approach to a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So we could get Tim on the podcast one of these times.
You need to get Tim on the podcast.
That's a good idea. Yeah.
We have many people. We need to get – we're listeners, know how hard it is just to get the four of us to have a spare hour to do this podcast. Gosh, it is tough. Well, we are going to get out our sunscreen and our lawn chairs and get outside and enjoy this beautiful weather. I'm sorry that it's not so beautiful in New York, Tom. Hopefully it will clear up later. And we hope everyone out there in the listening audience is having a good spring break, if it's your spring break this year, this week, and if not, in the coming weeks. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks on another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv. where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.